Hello, 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 and welcome to IC Radio. I'm Rena, and today on iScience Radio, we're going to talk about music and theatre, specifically the neuroscience of music and also the mental health benefits of music and theatre. And we have our lovely guests, Jack.
Hello.
Emma.
Hi.
And Priyanka.
Hi.
And yeah, but first, as always, we have Harry on the news. Well, except last week, but...
Thank you, Rena. So yeah, back to our iScience News Roundup. We'll continue our coverage of the mystery virus in China. So the coronavirus that originated in the Chinese city of Wuhan has now reached at least 13 countries with over 2,700 cases, 81 deaths, and tens of thousands being kept under medical supervision. Human-to-human transmission has now been confirmed, as well as the fact that the virus can spread before symptoms show, with a period of approximately 2 weeks, potentially. Chinese Health Minister Ma Xiaowei has also said that the ability of the virus to spread seems to be strengthening. And while it's not fully confirmed, genetic analysis suggests the virus may have been passed on to humans from snakes, which most likely originally got it from bats, both of which were being sold at the food market that they were looking at originally. Next up, Boris Johnson's new global talent visa. The government's announced they'll be implementing a fast-track visa next month to attract world-leading scientists. Being implemented on 20th February, there'll be no cap to the number of people that can come to UK under the visa, and will be managed by the UK Research and Innovation Agency rather than the Home Office, so that scientific credentials can be assessed by people who are qualified to do so and not just government authorities. Research organisations have been lobbying the government to put together a new system amid fears that Brexit could lead to a brain drain from Britain, but concerns remain around the UK's future role in EU research programmes. And finally, a new immune discovery that may treat all cancers. A recently discovered part of our immune system, specifically a new T-cell receptor, has shown to kill breast, lung, prostate and several other types of cancer in the lab, whilst leaving normal cells untouched. The research is still early stages and hasn't been tested in patients yet, but the researchers believe it could have enormous potential. Whilst T-cell therapies and other immunotherapies for cancer do exist and are being developed, they're normally highly specific and have most success in blood cancers, so not solid tumours. So a potential broad-stroke treatment could be very exciting.
Thank you so much, Harry, with the news roundup. So before we get into our first segment, we have a song by Bjork. This is Thunderbolt.
Staring at water's edge, cold frost on my twig. My mind in whirls, wonder. From whose hands have I too often? I'm craving miracles.
That was Thunderbolt by Bjork. And now we're going to talk about neuroscience of music. And Jack, hello, has
hello.
Brought in a clip from Amadeus, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So we just heard Bjork's Thunderbolt there, which was from her album Biophilia. And that was a track of music which used science. The bass line there, as you might have heard, used a Tesla coil. To create that sound there, and the clip that we're going to hear in a sec is a piece of theatre about music, and in particular about the power of music to elicit an emotional response. So what we're going to hear in just a second is a monologue from a play called Amadeus, which was by the writer Peter Schaffer, which is about Amadeus Mozart and his story told through another musician of the time called Salieri. Mm-hmm. And the clip that we're about to hear is from the original play production, which was on at the National Theatre in 1979. The actor we're going to hear is Paul Scofield, who is a fantastic actor. And he is playing the character of Salieri, talking about hearing Mozart's music and the impact that had on him.
That night, I heard Mozart's music for the first time. Some serenade for wind instruments, only vaguely at first, too horrified to attend. But presently the sound insisted, a solemn adagio in E flat. It started simply now. Just a pulse in the lowest register. Bassoon and basset horn, like a rusty squeeze box. It would have been comic except for the slowness, which gave it instead a sort of serenity. And then suddenly, high above it, sounded a single note on an oboe. It hung there, unwavering, piercing me through, till breath could hold it no longer, and a clarinet withdrew it out of me and softened it and sweetened it to a phrase of such delight it had me trembling. The lights flickered in the room. My eyes clouded. The squeeze box groaned louder, and over it the higher instruments wailed and warbled, throwing lines of sound around me. Long lines of pain around and through me. Oh, the pain. Pain as I had never known it. I called up to my sharp old God. What is this? What? But the squeeze box went on, and the pain cut deeper into my shaking head, and suddenly I was running downstairs, through the side door, out into the street, out into the dark night, gasping for life. What? What is this, signore? What is this pain? What is the need in the sound? Forever unfulfillable, and yet fulfilling him who hears it utterly. Is it your need? Can it be yours? Dimly the music sounded from the salon above. Dimly the stars shone on the empty street. I was suddenly frightened. It seemed to me that I had heard a voice of God, and that it issued from a creature whose voice I had also heard. And it was the voice of an obscene child.
Wow, that's, so, yes. Why was Salieri so, emotionally pained by Mozart's music.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things going on for him in that sequence there. The play, which is incredible, and the National Theatre did a version of it quite recently that you'll be able to find in cinemas and things like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was quite a famous film version of it as well that people can watch.
Yeah, I think that's where I've heard.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I heard the film first.
Yeah, yeah. And so what's going on in that scene is Salieri is a composer, an older composer who's around before Mozart, and is trying to compose the best music that he can to represent his religious ideas and his ambitions. And then he hears this piece and he's blown away because it's better than he can ever write. And yet it comes from this young whippersnapper who completely represents things that Salieri doesn't believe in. So there's an awful lot for him going on subtextually there in his response. But I think what I thought was particularly interesting about this piece for us in terms of the things that we're talking about today is all those emotions that come up and that Schofield performs there so dramatically. You know, we have lots of words there, delight and need and pain. Mm-hmm. And all these things, I think, well, certainly I've experienced listening to music. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think the idea that music can elicit such strong emotional feelings in us is an interesting one when we begin to unpick why that happens.
Yeah, I've always found it interesting how, to me, I think in some ways music is so much more primal than, you know, other things like, you know, vision or, obviously, like, it's somehow activates, like, this reptilian part. I hate to use that word, but it's sort of reptilian part of our brain, and we just, like, we have such strong emotional reactions to it. And, like, scientists think, believe that, you know, the reason why it's so, you know, it's so primal is just that it sort of came before language. It sort of came before, like, Homo sapiens, as in, like, the ability to create and respond to music or to dance to a beat might have come from, like, earlier evolutionarily, you know, before humans. And it's quite interesting, like, so when I read about this, it was like, our visual processing part of our brain, like the visual cortex, and the proportion of that, like, is smaller in Homo sapiens than it is in other primates. But all the auditory processing parts, like stuff to do with speech, to do with processing, like rhythm, pitch, harmony, melody, tonality, all of those things that they seem to be proportionally bigger in Homo sapiens than in other primates, and especially in the right hemisphere. For some reason, like, all of those things appear then when they did, like, studies on, like, brain imaging, you know, and the musicians as well have, like, stronger reactions to those things. And it's quite interesting to think how, like, why is music so fundamental to our human experiences?
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys have any other thoughts on, like, why this is, or yeah?
I can certainly say a little more there in terms of there's some interesting theories as to where this might have come from, and in terms of binding groups together. So part mm-hmm. of our experience of music is a very personal one, and is something that goes on, you know, within the secrecy of our own minds. But I think there's a very different experience that happens when we listen to music together. And I suppose that's something that we're going to come on to as we talk mm-hmm. about the experience of theatre as well. And the idea that communal singing was a way that groups would bind together, and that the strength of that bond would be an evolutionary advantage, would mean that hearing and responding to songs or noises and echoing those songs or noises would has an evolutionary advantage to it in terms of making groups communicate better.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, that there's quite a few theories floating around on that idea of communication being this upper strength that got traded off. And so there's this cognitive trade-off hypothesis, which talks about how humans traded into having communication and language as an evolutionary benefit over memory, like short memory. So we can't remember things at once, like apes used to be able to do that very short and quick memory, like that is useful in combat situations, that if there is 10 different predators attacking you from 10 different sides, mm-hmm. you'll be able to understand that, and like you need to be very quick in processing that. Mm-hmm. So that's what we traded for in place of communication. So that was an evolutionary advantage in the sense that the sense of community that we were talking about, that we can protect each other and we can signal each other to then hunt and gather and be the predator instead of the prey. Mm-hmm. So that became something that led to developing and strengthening of the communication skills. And yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that humans are like highly social animals.
Yeah.
I was going to say also when you were talking about group singing, it reminded me of something I mentioned a bit later. But for example, mothers like singing lullabies to their babies is something that's been practiced kind of throughout civilizations and like throughout the ages, and something that's very, very common. And there's quite a lot of research on it that shows that it has a very positive impact. Both on the baby in terms of eliciting kind of responsiveness and creating a bond, but also on the mother.
Right.
Also like for, again, like creating this mother-infant bond and also helping with kind of mental health, especially in a case of like postnatal depression, those kind of things. But yeah, and again, that's a practice that's like found, you know, commonly across the world, and is also a practice that helps kind of pass on traditions and pass on knowledge as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because how, you know, music came before language existed. I wonder if like other primates do that as well, or even other different animals other than like not that related to us, but they can still like respond to music in some ways.
Yeah,
maybe.
Definitely.
I'd like to think like maybe rhythm is one of those components. Maybe it's like evolutionarily advantageous to have some sort of strength in recognizing rhythm.
Hmm.
As you're thinking about how groups develop and how they invent those ways to develop, how can you signal that you are in agreement or understanding with another being? You know, how do you express the fact that my mind is of the same mind as you, obviously in a subconscious experience? And rhythm would absolutely be one of those ways. You know, I can respond to that sound in the same way that you are responding to that sound. Signals that we share some bond and communicate something there. In terms of animals that do that, you know, we can see things like
mating rituals, like
birds and stuff.
Birds and like a lot of apes as well, I think, do a lot of rhythmic stuff. Like rhythm plays a huge part in, I think, bonobos. I'm not quite sure, but the fact of what Jack was saying about rhythm being this inherently having this value of showing that you're on the same page, quite literally, that you are in agreement or not, that could play a huge factor in showing or signaling that you are in a group or part of another, perhaps.
Well, so that was all about the neuroscience and maybe how, like, evolutionarily music might play a part in, you know, forming humans. But next up, we'll have like stuff about mental health benefits on music and stuff. But first, we'll have another song. This is In My Feelings by Drake.
This shit got me in my feelings. Gotta be real with you. Yeah. Kiki
me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always, KB. Do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always. Look, the new me is really still the real me. I swear you gotta feel me before they try and kill me. They gotta make some choices, they running out of options. Cause I've been going off and they don't know when to stop. And when you get to top and I see that you've been learning. And when you get to shopping, you spend it like you earned it. And when you popped off on your ex, he deserved it. I thought you would've won from the jump, that confirmed it. Trap money, Benny. I buy you champagne, but you love some Henny. From the block like you Jenny. I know you special, girl, cause I know too many. Risha, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always. JT, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always.
Two bad bitches and we kissing in a rave. Kissing, kissing in a rave. Kissing, kissing in a rave. Black card in the cold to the safe. Cold to the safe, cold, cold to the safe, safe. I show 'em how to network. Fuck that Netflix and chill. What's your network?
Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always. And I'm down for you always. And I'm down for you, down for you, down for you always.
I got a new boy, and a nigga Trey.
Kiki, do you love me? Are you riding? Never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I need you, and I'm down for you always. KB, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave from beside me. Cause I want you, and I'm
skate and smoke and rap. Now let me see you bang that ass, bang that ass. Now let me see you.
Was In My Feelings by Drake. And since feelings play a large part in, you know, our mental health, here we have Emma, who will talk about the benefits of music.
Sweet, sweet segue. I grew up playing quite a lot of music, and you did too, Vina, and so you, we thought, this would be quite a nice episode to talk about this. I'm personally very glad that I got to do quite a lot of music growing up, and it was a huge part of my social life. And so I knew a lot of the friends that my childhood friends are basically all people I knew from music. I'm not really in touch with people from school anymore, but people I did music with, I'm still in, you know, good contact with, so it's very nice for that. So I started looking quite a lot into the general kind of health benefits, and especially mental health benefits, of practicing music, and there's actually a huge amount of literature on that, and a lot of that research is actually done next door at the Royal College of Music. They have a centre for performance science, and they work also with Imperial, and they do quite a lot of research on those kind of issues, there are quite a lot of examples of music practice being very beneficial for mental health. There's also examples for dementia, kind of general well-being, and also sort of developments in kids and those kind of things. So for example, there was that study that I mentioned earlier, where they were looking at the effect of lullabies on mothers, and especially in the case of postnatal depression, which is not, which is kind of a depression that's not particularly well treated, if I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they found there was a very clear association between mothers who would practice kind of singing daily to their babies and would show kind of much reduced signs of depression and report a much better mother-infant bond and those kind of things, and much better well-being and self-esteem. Obviously, it's not direct, like, causal link, but mm-hmm. there's a very, very clear association with that. And there was also, for example, an example of the effect of singing in a choir with dealing with grief, for example, and bereavement. Oh. So there was it was a study that it did with it was something like 60 adults or something who had lost someone to cancer in the past 5 years. And we're dealing with kind of mental health problems as a result of that. And then some of them chose to join a choir, and they would basically practice weekly for an hour and a half for like a few months. And then they sort of had some kind of assessment at the end of that. And there was a very clear link between the participants who sang in the choir, and they all kind of showed, you know, much more stable symptoms of depression and better, you know, a lot of improvements in their sense of self-esteem and self-efficacy. Whereas the control group was not showing any of the signs, and if anything, the kind of depression was getting worse.
Right. Why do they think that is?
Yeah, so that's something we can discuss. So they mention a few things in this study, which is, first of all, of course, it brings, you know, a sense of community, and that's, you know, you get that from choir, but you will also get that from a lot of different arts, you know, like theatre mm-hmm. and whatever. And especially because it's also a choir with other people who were struggling with the same kind of issues. Obviously, it was like a very understanding community that was very helpful for people. And also because it's like a weekly event, there's this sense of like constancy is, you know, something they can look forward to every week. That was very helpful. And also in terms of the repertoire that they sung, like they had a lot of songs that dealt with loss and with those issues, but also more upbeat songs. And it was like a very different way to kind of approach, you know,
cope with.
Exactly. Yeah. And also like singing, there's a lot of studies that show that kind of singing helps build self-confidence, for example, which obviously like contributed to that. And there's quite a lot of examples of this that are quite similar. There was another study that was done with again people kind of recovering from mental health disorders who joined a drumming, like djembe drumming group, I think.
Right.
And like again that reported a lot
African drums.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Congo. No, the other ones. Okay, sorry.
Djembe, I don't know. Yeah. It's called djembe, but I'm not an expert in African drumming. But yeah, again, like they report a lot of, you know, benefits. So yeah, and these are a few examples. There's also examples of it being very useful in terms of healthcare for dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Jack, you worked with that a little bit in the theatre context.
That's right. Yeah. So many moons ago, I used to work in the theatre quite a lot, and there's a lot of social care work that goes on in and around theatre buildings. You know, they're a place for communities to come together. And in particular, I was thinking of one example of that. We were working on a new piece of writing up at Theatre Clwyd, which is in North Wales, a town called Mold. And there they had a group of people with dementia and their carers, their primary carers, who would meet each time a new show came in. I was part of the acting company of a play called Pilgrims, so three of us in that. And we did a workshop with with that group, so we'd do a few kind of basic theatre games with them, and then just talk to them about the play, and they then came to watch a relaxed performance of the play. And a relaxed performance is something a lot of theatres do. It just means it's more accessible for anyone with particular needs, so people can leave whenever they want, come back in. The lights aren't fully down, so you can see around you, so you know if people might get confused mm-hmm. or upset, then it's easier for them to get support. This particular play was kind of a tricky one, I think, for the group to digest, yeah, because it was one of those ones that jumped about all over the place time wise. So you'd skip 5 years ahead and then 10 years behind, and I think you know, we had a really good time talking to the group about that. But I just thought in particular that what a brilliant thing for the theatre there to have set up, because again it was about people coming together, not being isolated, being able to talk to other people who were going through the same things. And I think, you know, they'd had so much positive feedback from the people being part of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that kind of sustained arts engagement, whether it is going to the opera or going to concerts or to the theatre or all those kind of things, is just generally associated with much better well-being, especially in adults. But then, of course, that also probably reflects the fact that people who can have access to, you know, that to those opportunities are usually people who come from, you know, more wealthy kind of socioeconomical backgrounds, or just have better access in cities or stuff like that. But it's, I guess it's worth thinking about that, you know, arts engagement can be, you know, very kind of, to some extent, quite cost-effective and sustainable way to sort of improve well-being, but that's only viable if we at the same time, you know, put in place kind of policies that can tackle those inequalities and access. And
I completely agree with that. There's a big funding drive over the last few years which has been towards rural theatre, and that's supporting touring groups that can go to places that wouldn't otherwise have big theatre productions there. And I think that's absolutely it. It's sort of saying, okay, this thing is beneficial to people, well, let's make sure that everyone has access to it, not just people with loads of money who live in the big city.
And I think as well, like, not just like theatre and stuff, I think it's just more beneficial to have just like different programs that allow people to express themselves in different ways, like dance as well, and like just art as well. I think it's always been, I think, like, arts in general has always been like a good way for us to like express ourselves and like self-reflect as well.
I think that's one of the bigger factors, that as humans, it's not just the, like, even a person who is, say, involved in doing something, even artistic, for a long duration of time, it's breaking the monotony of it that is the key factor here, I think. So to engage in arts is to give the mind that intellectual freedom and that exploration and the delight of doing something different. And of course, that is a huge factor, that what you said, Emma, about it being a socioeconomic privilege as well. So I feel that that is something that we have now created a problem for ourselves right now, of having these beautiful things, but in our appreciation and in our appreciation of it, we have sort of put it up into a pedestal, which has made it inaccessible for others.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's so many benefits to also, we were talking about adults for a while, but like just in terms of when you're growing up as a kid, there's so many benefits to being able to engage with arts, whether it's music or dance or drawing or theatre, whatever. Like, I mean, you, just in terms, like, just physically, for, like, you know, developing fine motor skills and building self-confidence, being a social group, I don't know, learning to communicate in a way that's not necessarily, like, you know, non-verbal communication, all of these are just so helpful. And it's, I don't know, it's such a shame that, you know, there's such a barrier for some people to be able to access those, people who, you know, could, you know, would benefit hugely from being able to access that. And, I was talking to, recently, I was, it's slightly different, but I was talking to a girl who is a musician, and she's also deaf, so she, and she's very profoundly deaf, but she, so she wears hearing aids, and she can kind of hear through those, and so she performs music using those and just talking. And actually, interestingly, she says that in a way, speech is much harder for her to understand than music. For her, music is much easier language. But she does quite a lot of teaching, of music teaching with deaf kids. Precisely because she says, you know, there's just so much it can gain from music. And especially music, especially in classical music, there's very much a stigma with kind of hearing impairment. And a lot of it is very much, you know, if you have a good ear, that means you're a good musician kind of thing. But she was saying, you know, it's because there's this idea that, you know, music equals sound and equals what your ear can do. Mm. You know, you let out so many, you prevent so many kids who might not hear as well as other kids from, you know, being able to enjoy all of those kind of activities. And so she does a lot of work with deaf kids, and she says like it's very helpful for them, and you see they really enjoy it. And she goes to schools quite a lot to do that, so she's really nice. She's called Eloise Garland. Actually, she has a couple of episodes on BBC Radio 4. I think she made a kind of podcast with them when she was talking about that. So if you guys are interested, I recommend listening to it. She's really inspiring girl. She's really nice.
We'll put some links on that on the website later. We'll just have a little break. This is Everybody Wants to Be Famous by Super Organism.
Feeling like a frost and staring at the stars. It doesn't matter the cost, 'cause everybody wants to be famous. I'm calling the shots, so see you over at Mars. It doesn't matter the cost, seems like everybody wants to be famous. I think it could be.
Was Everybody Wants to Be Famous by Super Organism. So yeah, we'll continue in the same vein about how arts, especially theater, can help with like cognitive development and like you know, our mental health in general.
Yeah, so at this point a case study comes to mind, which happens in the hallways of 2004 in Amherst College. And so basically what they did was they did a study on an age group or age cohort of around 6-8 people aged from 60 years to 86 years. And it had a group participation of around 124 people. Mm-hmm. So it was not a huge case study, but for people studies, 124 is quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they did was they had groups, them divided into four groups, and one group had... all of them were treated to 4 weeks of workshops and intervention with activities. So the activities were like this. The one group was having 4 weeks of theater arts treated to activities and engagement with theater arts, theater mm-hmm. activities, improv. The second was non-content specific visual arts.
Okay.
Second group. And the third group. Oh, so sorry, it was just three groups. And the third was no treatment. And so basically they would just gather, so the community thing would also come into factor, but it wasn't, they weren't especially engaging with some sort of art form or visual mm-hmm. art form or theater art form. And it was seen that, and four criteria were studied. So the criteria that was seen was word recall, memory, problem solving, and overall psychological well-being.
Okay.
And in the theater arts group, after 4 weeks, there was definite significant improvement in all four set criteria.
So just, sorry, that was
word recall. So their ability to recall words or things in short-term memory, and mm-hmm. then memory. So because the age group we were talking about is age 60 to 86, so memory also becomes a very big factor in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then problem solving. So I assume, I'm not quite remembering what the paper was, but problem solving, I think they would have been given like problem situations, and that would have been like a before and after testing of those mm-hmm. things.
Okay.
And overall psychological well-being, again, I think these were psychoanalytic tests rather than simulatory tests. So,
okay.
So these would mostly be tests like Wallach Keegan tests or random association of words tests, kind of things, which have questionnaires and then interpreted answers based off that.
Okay.
So
with the ink block.
Yes, Rorschach's test. So there are many studies on such effects of theater, and the Rorschach does play a huge role
okay.
In analyzing things, but it would have to be paired with a nice setup. So it does not individualistically speak of theater's effects. So mm-hmm. if it's mm-hmm. like a before and after, so depending on how the person then interprets few things could speak of their state of minds. Again, these are all interpretive and based on statistics and probability mm-hmm, mm-hmm. as is the case with many psychoanalytic studies, but still this speaks to a significant peer-reviewed effect of theater on creativity and cognition. So, and also the interesting thing to be noted here was that, so 4 weeks we saw that, of course, if you're engaging, you're active and you will remember, and the community thing could also play part.
Mm-hmm.
But it was seen that in that theater group, even 4 months after the project was completed, the levels were maintained in word recall and memory. So the improvement continued till that point.
That's even interesting. Do you know how well the second group did?
I remember the visuals did like in 2 out of 4 things, but didn't do it in all the four. But like okay. the visuals also had like very good effect on their the word recall and problem solving, but I'm okay. not quite sure. But it the visual also did quite significantly better than the no treatment. So the no treatment was more like a control group. It gave results of general, it sort of defined the threshold
mm-hmm.
and like the background noise. But that was quite interesting to see.
So
what I did in my college when I was studying my undergrad, so what I did was I wanted to see if this works as well in undergrads as well.
Okay.
So I got around, and I used to do a bit of theater, so I asked my director if I could run a theater workshop with these students,
mm-hmm.
and he kindly agreed. So okay. basically what I did was I got in science students from, again, like, different backgrounds who did not have any previous theater experience whatsoever. And we did, so my studies were not conclusive because it was like just experimental and coming out of a lot of background context.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it for 2 weeks and I did pre-studies. So I did the random association test, the creativity tests. Mm-hmm. And so again, those were psychoanalytic tests. And the results that you got were very low in comparison to the results you got for those experiment group, not the control group. Mm-hmm. So the experiment group were the group that were treated to the theater experiments and everything, and they showed a marked improvement in memory and creativity. And those were aged like 18 to 21.
Okay, yeah, so undergrad. How many people?
Those were the participants were around 50 participants. Okay. So, but still, like, it was quite interesting to see. It cannot be taken as a conclusive study, mm-hmm. because of the small data set, mm-hmm. and psychoanalytic studies. But I felt that it was quite a good confirmation point of this literature that already exists. The University of Liverpool has also done studies like that. Amherst College did, and there's quite a few studies that say. So let's debate, like, what could be the reason? Maybe let's debate.
I just want to roll back a little bit, and I just want to know. I'm just interested in like why you chose to.
The reason I chose to do this was because at that point I was involved in theater a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we also used to do a course called Effective Communication, ECPDT, which was Effective Communication and Personality Development Through Theater. So basically, okay. The course was people coming from very underprivileged socioeconomic backgrounds, mm-hmm. and so they used to do these courses where they would have theater exercises, improv, and they would extend like for 2-3 months, and it showed a marked improvement in gaining confidence, in gaining people, like those were people lost stammers, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a huge transformation to make, especially in sciences where a lot of stress is put on just education, at least in India, and just the rote studying. And then you're just thrown into the world where you have to cope with things like presentations, meetings.
I just got really, because I really identify with that, because I feel like it's the same in a lot of Asian cultures. Yeah. I don't want to generalize too much, especially in Hong Kong, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's what we used to see, that there were a lot of people who just like were so introverted. And after the theater, they would just open up. I mean, the transformation was visible. And I just wanted to validate that through some scientific study. So that's what was my intention behind that. So I was just going around finding guides to say, no, this is because I have a study and everything. This is not because I want to say theater rules. It's like nothing.
I mean, it does, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, not the easiest in a science college, sorry.
I have to say, like, I am I'm very impressed with anyone who does theatre. Yeah. And, like, I think this is probably is the root with quite a lot of people, that I just find it absolutely terrifying just the thought of it, of being on stage. But I don't know, maybe one day I should.
It just helps with confidence, I guess.
It's just the thought of it gives me anxiety.
At this theater workshops, and like, because we used to also deal with a lot of the students who then came into the course, and they would it would be a very personal journey as much as it would be a communal thing, because mm-hmm. once you're in theater, you just open yourself up spiritually, emotionally, physically to the people around you, and it creates such a safe space. And it's wonderful to have that. It becomes your family away from home. So I was away from home because mm-hmm. I was studying in this mm-hmm. college, but like, it does create that safe space for you, and it's like therapy, and it is a beautiful experience, and it makes you realize, get to such great realizations about you.
Yeah.
I think it's I can see that even without the scientific validations, it definitely takes you through the spiritual journey because of the factors that are at stake in your life at that point, I think.
So I presume you've been in like a lot of productions and stuff yourself, right?
Yeah, but like I've been very few on stage, but I was a more backstage person. But like, because you have to do all that, so our theater group, we used to do all the activities, all the improvs, everything together. And like, we would sit in on the creative decisions. So we would work with the actors. It was So it was everything done and produced, sets, everything by us. So we just did everything. So that became like a small troupe family for us.
Nice. Do you have like stories like...
Yeah, I guess Jack, you're probably... When did you... I'm curious actually, when did you start... because obviously you've done a lot of theatre, but did you start that when you were quite young? Or was that something you took up at university? I don't know how that works.
It was something I guess I started... quite young, but not in comparison to a lot of people that I know. So I think I was about 12 or 13. Right. And it was there was a girl at school.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't it sound like
it's the eternal story. Yeah. I started at 12 or 13 and just carried on doing it since then, really. But I totally agree. I think for me, there was always much more enjoyment doing than watching or anything like that. You know, I think there's a huge amount of benefit, and we saw exactly the same. I certainly transformed a huge amount over the time doing it. You know, I still remember my first show when I had lines in. I was terrified. Yeah. I was completely. But you know, you develop and you build those skills and that confidence over time, and I think we saw so many people transform in the group that I had, and they were absolutely the best of friends. I'm still friends with lots of them now. In each production, people kind of joke about those actor games and things like that people do at the start of shows. But really what that's about is,
bonding.
It's building trust.
Those trust exercises, especially. Like, we used to have exercises where there would be free falls, and it would
did
not...
Did you catch them?
Yeah, we would just like... You were lucky. We actually did. So in one production, it was like a musical thing, and I was on stage for that. So I'm not taking any responsibility right now. But like, so what happened was that it was basically you had to climb on each other's shoulders and then fall, and the others would catch.
Yeah.
And it was a musical cue, and in one of the rehearsals we all had to turn at some point, and the girl would have already fallen, so we would have to turn in time to catch her. But like, it got misplaced by a second and she fell and the show was like in 2 days, but like, and like, I can just imagine, like, you would have to have so much faith in your colleagues to then still go and do that again and again.
Was the girl okay?
Yeah, it was like a 5 feet person standing on top of a 5 feet person. So it was like a straight fall from it is bad.
Bit of a height.
It is a bit of a height, but like, still, like, at that point we were all bruised because it had a lot of stunts in that. But still,
oh my God.
Yeah, but still, it's the faith to get injured and still keep doing that. It just has to take and those experiences make you bond in undefinable ways.
That's amazing. I personally don't have as much background in theater. I mean, I did a few musicals when I was younger, but I've always felt like it was such like a fun, like, because personally I came from like a classical music background, and sometimes, you know, as much as I love classical music, I've always felt like, you know, sometimes I wish I was on stage, because you just have to think about so much more, I think. But like, also, like, you also have the freedom to do a lot more. I don't know, just like from the orchestra pit, sometimes I just look up and I'm just like, oh, I want to be there. So yeah. Anyway, that's... Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Jack, Emma, and Priyanka.
No, it was fun. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
And as appropriately, we're going to finish off with the song by Rihanna. This is Take a Bow.
Oh, how about a round of applause? Yeah, standing ovation. So dumb right now, standing outside my house, trying to apologize. You're so ugly when you cry. Please just cut it out.
but you put on quite a show.